Let's talk small. Let's talk about tiny Eiffel Towers, flea circuses, dolls' houses made for queens, weird tableaus of crime scenes, miniature food, model villages, miniature railways. Fabulous. A new book called In Miniature joins us now to talk about this is Simon Garfield, who's got, written the book. Morning, Simon. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning, Bill. Morning.
Good to talk to you. Well, this is a great idea for a book, and it's people are kind of obsessed, aren't they, and have been over the years with making things small.
Yeah, I mean, it's that classic thing that we all begin playing with small things when we're kids. It's the only way, I think, that we have any sort of control over the world when we're little, you know. So our parents are in charge or our teachers are in charge, but if we can run a little model railway in our bedroom or Lego or whatever it is, then we have a sense or a chance, I suppose, of thinking, actually, I'm in charge now. And it sort of begins individually from there. Now, some people obviously grow out of it, and some people don't. And yeah. I was interested in the people who don't, really. I mean, either as a hobby, so I obviously talk a lot about model villages and model railways and all of that, but also people who do it for a career. So, you know, if you're an architect, you will model small first. You know,
yes.
You will try and show the building. If you're an artist building a big sculpture, you will probably do a small maquette version of it as well.
Mm.
So
that's
the thing. Plus, as you mentioned in your introduction, I've written many books, and I've never, ever been able to write about the flea circus before. So this was my ambition was realized finally.
Brilliant. So it's almost about taking back control. One thinks that maybe Theresa May is probably hoping she could have miniaturized the entire United Kingdom. That would have made it a lot easier for her, wouldn't it?
God, I don't know. I mean, what an extraordinary thing we're going through. I do actually say in the book, I go to a model village called Beaconscott, which is
yes.
in Beaconsfield, about 40 minutes drive out of London, and a remarkable place. It's pretty much thought of as the oldest existing model village in the world, so it's coming up to its 90th birthday next year. In fact, no, this year. And I thought, looking around it is a sort of Brexit Britain, really. It's very kind of old school. It doesn't like the sort of outside influence terribly much. And it's a sort of idealistic Britain. I think it's a Britain that a lot of people, without getting too political this morning, I think a lot of people kind of thought this would be, you know, the ideal world leaving Europe.
And yes.
So far it's turning out to be something else. But we will see what happens with that.
Does the model village have a really tiny hard border across it?
Well, I mean, interesting enough, of course, it is totally, as are all these model villages, it's totally self-contained.
Yeah.
But it is, to its credit, it is, although it's mostly set, supposed to be the 1930s, it does have new bits from the 1930s popping up in it all the time. So it's not a... It's anything but a dead place. The question is there any thriving industry? Not really. There's no factories. The transport seems to run okay. There's lots of trains running through it. But a beautiful place. So, you know, who knows? Maybe we'll recapture that in years to come.
Who knows? One of the places you talk about in the book, I must confess, I've been twice to, because I enjoyed it so much the first time that was desperate to go back. I used to love train sets when I was young, and I went to visit my chum in Hamburg, and they have there the brilliant miniature Wonderland, which is the train set to end all train sets.
Oh, it's extraordinary. So you are, I mean, it's only been going from about 2000 or so, and
yeah.
It's you are one of, I think now they must have 16 million people
wow.
who have passed through their doors. It's now one of the leading tourist attractions in Europe, and it's an extraordinary place. I mean, what interests me about it is that it's that classic thing on a grand scale that we Well, I'm obviously talking for myself now, but I'm sure this will resonate with some of your listeners as well, is that, you know, often as kids, you don't quite get the toys that you want, and you have to wait for your own kids to obviously get the scale electric set or the model railway. And this has happened on a grand scale. So these two brothers basically thought that they always wanted a model railway, and they made their money in nightclubs, and they thought, as a in full adulthood, that I know what we should do. We should build the model, the biggest model railway in the world.
Of course.
And that's, of course, what they've done. And a model railway on its own, sort of just going round, this is in fact in a disused, well, as you know, disused coffee warehouse by the docks,
yeah.
is not very interesting. But obviously what makes it interesting is the landscape that it passes through. So obviously they built Mini Germany, and then they expanded and Mini Italy, and then they went to America and built Las Vegas and other things. I mean, it's a bizarre world, isn't it, there?
Because, totally. And as you say, it's not just trains there, it's everything. So you've got planes taking off, you've got ships running along, you've got little people milling around, little cars. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And to their credit, they do sort of try and represent the real world, whereas sort of a lot of model villages are kind of ideal places, places that we wish the world was like. This is a more, I mean, albeit at a tiny, tiny scale, this is a more realistic vision of the world, you know. So there are things that we would do from day to day. There's a massive pop concert. There is a traffic jam. There are accidents. There's a bit of crime that you can see. You know, that kind of stuff. There are traffic jams.
There's a seasons, and it goes day and night as well, doesn't it? It goes through the whole... Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a fantastic technological feat. The only thing I felt a little bit odd about it was that it sort of, what I was really interested in my book was talking to people who spent their lifetime, maybe, you know, with an obsessive hobby, you know, building things small. And this was clearly a very, very skilled enterprise, and they have done a fantastic job, and they are, it's ever expanding as well. But it's sort of impossible without a huge amount of money and a huge amount of, you know, investments from banks and all that kind of stuff. Everything. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I did feel that it's something that, is actually being replicated, in fact, by people who just see it as a tourist attraction. Now, not to say there's not a lot of love there as well, but there's a place, and I'm not going to win any friends in New York by saying this, but there's a place in New York, pretty much at 42nd Street in Manhattan, called Galava's Gate. And that's another kind of mini world that they've created. And it's pretty much a tourist trap, you know. It's not, I'm not saying it's not done well, but it's done, I think, more than anything else to make money. And that's something I slightly balk at, because I'm aware of, the world is full of so many miniature hobbyists who, you know, have spent their lifetime building. So I talked, for instance, you know, to one guy who has spent pretty much, he's now in his 80s, he spent pretty much his entire life building 440 warships out of
matches.
So he began with one and thought, yes, I can do this. This was when he was, you know, in his teens, and he's been doing it ever since. And what a fantastic thing. I mean, totally nuts, of course.
Brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah. You mentioned flea circuses earlier on. Now, they were very, very popular in Victorian era. And in fact, they're even mentioned apparently in the House of Commons in relation to animal protection in the 1920s. So they didn't have much to talk about in the Commons in those days, did they? and of course, Michael Benteen, after they kind of disappeared, kept them going with a mechanical flea circus.
Yeah, you're not the first person to mention him to me. He's actually, of course, now I wish I'd mentioned him in the book, and I only remembered Michael Benteen's potty time when the book was in. So clearly I have to put that into the paperback.
Definitely.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a bizarre thing. This used to be, hard as it might be to believe now, a huge attraction all over Europe, especially popular in Britain. Germany had quite a few of them as well. And they were real things. So I didn't know until I researched it. I kind of thought the flea circus was sort of a bit of a myth or maybe a bit of a scam. Mm. But actually, it was a real thing. And fleas did pull, you know, chariot, and they did have jewels, and they did, you know, leap through hoops. Why they did this was not sadly of their own volition. They did it because if you keep a flea in a little tiny jar or pot for 23 and a half hours and let them out and then tie them up, which they did, around their necks often, or legs, and they will do anything to, you know, sort of use up their pent-up energy as a flea. So they will appear to pull a chariot along, you know, a four-inch track. Actually, all they're trying to do is obviously get that damn thing off their neck, sort of restricting their movement. And they will appear to fight a duel, but in fact what will happen is, you know, these tiny little bits of metal have been tied to their legs, and all they're doing when they shake them and appear to be fighting is actually trying to get them off their legs. But anyway, so you paid a shilling and you went to see this thing, and the flea master was, you know, pretty much a kind of like a circus barker. He was sort of the MC, and he would concoct all sorts of scenarios about his fleas and all sorts of myths. And because there was quite a lot of competition, again, hard enough to believe, they invented the things that were scams. Were they invented all these sort of backstories about their fleas. So they had a story which they planted in the press of one of their fleas had escaped and then was found to have checked into the, you know, the local hotel and things. So,
oh, I love it. What a fantastic thing. And we can't not mention this incredible doll's house that was made for Queen Mary, which basically involved around 1,500 people and pretty much all of the creative luminaries and the kind of major players of the time contributed towards this thing.
Yeah, this is a remarkable thing. I mean, if your listeners, you know, go to Windsor Castle, this is one of the reasons for going there at all. I mean, it's there were huge queues to see this thing, and it's now owned by the Queen. It was built in the 1920s for Queen Mary, as you say. The man in charge was the architect Edwin Lutyens, and he enlisted absolutely all the great and the good of the creative world, the artistic world, the literary world, to draw or to write miniature artworks. Arthur Conan Doyle wrote a special Sherlock Holmes tale, you know, which was just a few pages long, but he hand-wrote it, and this is, you know, just a few inches tall and fits in the library, and, you know, gosh, I mean, we can't open it as people are looking at it, sadly, but I think only the Queen is allowed to open it.
Okay. You know?
And it's a remarkable thing. It comes up to the whole Doll's House, which contains all these things, and there's also, you know, like a real gramophone that works, that was made by HMV, you know, at a tiny scale, really mind-boggling stuff. And you go around, it's now obviously all encased in glass, but yeah, you can go around it, and the whole housing sort of lifts up on a hydraulic system, so you can see all around it, and highly recommended.
And just mind-boggling as to how you could possibly do something that small. How could you replicate the Mona Lisa in less than a square millimetre using an eyelash or a paintbrush?
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. No, I talked to this guy who is very well known now as a sort of micro miniature artist and sculptor, and he makes these extraordinary things which you can only really see properly most of them under a microscope.
Wow.
Certainly under a magnifying glass, and uses, you know, as you say, you know, this sort of eyelashes and those kind of things as a paintbrush and recreate extraordinary things. I mean, what you need, of course, is a number of things. You need immense patience.
Yeah.
You need a lot of skill.
Yeah.
I think you need to be a bit mad. There's definitely an element where you kind of ultimately say, you know, why am I doing
this? Yes.
Because it's a fascinating thing to do and because you can do it.
I'd also think you need to have stayed off the drink for a considerable period of time.
Yeah, I mean, so this guy who painted this tiny, tiny Mona Lisa within a copy of Mona Lisa, he basically put this tiny whole copy of the Mona Lisa within her eye. So you just get an idea. It looks like a kind of tiny glint of light within her eye. And he says that he operates, first of all, you know, only at night, because obviously the air has to be sort of more, everything has to be more quiet.
Yeah.
And he also, and it probably helps his concentration, he also claims, although I still haven't quite been able to work out in my mind how this works, that he operates and paints between heartbeats. So he claims that he's able to control his heart and knows when his heart will beat, so that it's just less of a vibration on his hand when he's doing it. But there are calamities. So he was reconstructing. I think it was Alice in Wonderland's Mad Hatter's Tea Party, which he was going to put on the eye. Within the eye of a needle, which is often what he does. So he often operates either within the eye of a needle or on the pin of a needle or a pinhead. And he claims one day that he was working on Alice and he breathed in at the wrong time and inhaled Alice. There we are. So all that hours and hours and hours of work trying to... Went down his throat. So there you go. That's a warning for listeners.
No.
You might want to be doing this kind of work.
That's awful. I'm sorry to laugh at it, but what an awful story, man. God. Oh, dear. Well, I tell you what, it's a brilliant book, Simon. It's called In Miniature, and all that stuff and much more is in there. There's tiny Eiffel Towers and all kinds of other things we still haven't had time to talk about. Been a pleasure to talk to you today, Simon. All the best. We'll talk to you again soon.
Great talking to you, Bill.
Cheers, take care, Simon. Bye. Bye.